For whatever shortcomings our culture may have, and to be sure there are many, one thing seems certain. Most men are given a fairly generous span of time, at least to decide on a way of life, on a style of expression, on a manner of work and accomplishment. Gregor Piotrogorsky apparently had neither desire nor need for this gift of time. He started playing the cello when he was 6 years old. At 9, he was a member of a motion picture theater orchestra. At 15, he was appointed first cellist of the Imperial Opera in Moscow. Shortly after, he began giving concerts of his own and quickly became known as a truly great cello virtuoso. What he accomplished by way of his superlative musicianship and his creative artistry stands as a unique model for our time. And yet, during this active and prolific musical career, Gregor Piotrogorsky has had reason and desire to look beyond the world of music, to search and probe human needs and human values, and to raise important questions about them. And so when we met, we talked about such things, and I asked him what he would say if, at this time in his life, he were to describe the values which for him had come to be basic, important, and enduring.
Say to love the work you're doing, to be lucky enough to find right outlet for your expression, for your contribution, and to love, to be fascinated with the work you're doing. I think this is the most essential thing. Too many people do the thing they hate instead to love. So then it becomes a chore. Then it becomes purely economical problems, problems of opportunity. But if you are lucky enough to dedicate your life to something you love, to something that is greater than you are, as someone said, then you are a lucky person indeed.
Is it so easy to find something of this sort, though?
I think it's the most difficult thing on earth to find, really, to hit on the wall that is right, that corresponds to your character, your talent. It's the most difficult thing. And it is also a question of luck. You can see, for instance, Maestro Toscanini. And Maestro Toscanini, whom I have a good fortune to know very well, originally he was a cellist. I don't know how happy he was with the choice of his instrument, but I'm fairly sure about one thing, that we would not know Maestro Toscanini as what he was if he would not, by coincidence, the two expressions of his is conducting, which came quite by accident. So now, sometimes, even in music, you just had the misfortune to choose a wrong instrument. Mm-hmm. As someone who might have been a composer of importance decided to play a clarinet, you see, and would come. So that is very essential to, from early age, to find the work you're capable of learning. And as a matter of fact, you don't have to be an artist. I don't believe people shall separate artists from the rest of the humanity. They would say, well, this is an artist now, and I'm just working in the office, or I have a little shop where I sell things. I do believe that everyone who does something well, everyone who would do things, even if they're not paid for, of the pure love for the interest, enthusiasm, fascination of the thing, it will become automatically an artist.
Can you find beauty in all of these things and having the shop?
I think so. Only those profession which has a great deal of beauty in it are, unfortunately, still are done by man instead by machine. And those professions which are lovable, which could be fascinated for for the humanity, they are done by machines. It should be reversed. I don't think that there should be actually too many factories of whatever we use, of furniture, of things. In the older times, there were great artisans.
Yeah.
They were artists with pride. They put their name on. Mm-hmm. Today we see it in museums. It should be done by people. Mm-hmm. By people's hands, so that their life pass in beauty, in fascination, in adventure, in dignity.
This is what I'm concerned with, that there is a loss in this sense of pride. And with a student who comes in, Mr. Pyatigorsky, you see them, as I do on our campus. They don't have much time to look around, and they have a sense of pressure. They have to settle on something. What does one say to these students who are looking for something exact and definite? They want to go right now.
Well, that is a... that's a very essential. They live under great pressure.
Mm.
They have to have so many units. Someone would get 4 units or 3 units for Spanish, so he would study Spanish, or although he's not particularly interested in the language itself, or Cervantes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, it is a tremendous waste of time. Because I believe on, particularly, of course, in music, it must not be a dull moment. Because the boredom still remains the greatest danger of humanity, the enemy of humanity. As now, particularly in this specialized time, when the people have to concentrate on one particular thing,
how have you missed it, though? You have the vigor and the enthusiasm. Where did it come from? What happened to you?
Well, I was very fortunate when I was little to see the cello. And that was that. I fell in love with it. It was rather simple. Not only of the sound of the cello. You see, Stradivari, for instance, made those magnificent scrolls on the cello. Now, actually, you can, instead of a beautiful scroll, you can put a hook. It would not affect the sound. Yes, but it would affect your aesthetic pleasure. So it is also actually visual. It's very important that the varnish is beautiful. That the scroll is like a head of a god. It's magnificent, and it is together, you see, it woven together. Everything that's beautiful is connected, and now you have to search for the beauty. And there is so much of it. Only it had to be discovered. Sometimes it has to be taught to see the beautiful instead to be poisoned by self-criticism, which is, if it is overdone, can be deadly. Very often it is. Because you don't have to be a genius to see your shortcomings at all. But it needs quite an effort to find something positive in you and to develop it, to dwell on it, and to convert the negative to positive. I believe in that. I believe in people's gifts. I believe in beauty. And I believe that in every man there is awful lot of very beautiful that they have to discover themselves in order to give a fine contribution to their fellow man.
Mr. Pyatigorsky, you enjoy your teaching. I can feel it, and I can hear it in what you're saying here.
Yes, I love. I love teaching, yes. I love. I love to see things grow. It's a tremendous pleasure when I travel to see in the orchestras, every part of the world, one of my kids sitting there as first cellist, and it's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
How do you give them this sense of beauty and the suggestion to look within and see oneself?
Well, of course, the most important thing is to know that I'm their friend, and that I, as teacher, see their gifts, that I see the positive in them. That is very important. And actually, it gives them, I hope, encouragement and to unfold the best of them. That was a very curious incident in Berlin. And I was teaching there. And among my students, there was one whom I particularly admire. It was extraordinary talent. I gave him all time in the world and all effort. I just wanted to give him all I got. It was a heavenly talent. And to my disdain, this poor boy, from lesson to lesson, became worse and worse, because I played for him better and better. As a matter of fact, I never played the concert performances as well as for him, until probably he must have lost hope or something. And I always give examples. He would play, then I would play.
You would play it also?
Yes, I would play, you know, so that he really hears, you know, that something. Well, the result was, of course, the greatest catastrophe, because I murdered him. I lost my sleep too, because I just did not know why all other students of mine made fine progress. And this one, exceptional student of mine, has such a disastrous result. Well, until I tried to play less well for him, I thought maybe this is the point. And gradually, I began to play for him worse and worse. And he was better and better. Until when he graduated, it was a triumph. Actually, it was magnificent. And as I rushed him to congratulate him, he stood with other students that have some discussions. But as I approached him, he disappeared. And one of the students said, "Well, this impertinent fellow, he dared to say that you are a very fine teacher, but certainly a lousy cellist." Well, he has all the reason. I certainly played. But I consider this as the greatest compliment that I ever received from a student.
The sacrifice of the teacher, though.
It was not even a sacrifice. One should do everything for them so that they advance, to see their progress, instead of making out of the student one's adoring public. They are not. They're there to learn.
I can see it in music, Mr. Piatigorsky. Where else does one find beauty? Where else have you seen it in your own life?
Well, practically in everything, because I have trained for it. Every day, for me, it is a new discovery. You see, I have not signed a contract with the nature that there will be tomorrow, and there will be sunshine or rain. It's gifts, it's presents that we are bestowed with. There's absolutely no end of gratitude that I feel. There is, in short, nothing better than life. Almost any life.
Yet you see on the parts of so many musicians And I suppose I shouldn't say only musicians, on the parts of so many people. This frightened tightness of one day to the next, their feeling that the world must go on for them as they want it, as they plan it, a peculiar kind of selfish, small view of the world. How do you get one kind of person and how do you get another?
Well, we live now in a time of fear, doom, tension, pressure. And now you remember our friend Huxley. He's also a preacher of doom. He predicts things full of gloom and disaster. Now, while other people like Dr. DuBridge, quite the contrary, is very optimistic. He says that the freshmen at the university are brilliant, marvelous. Now, I remember the same friend of ours, the man we admire so much, Huxley. Once he came to dinner at my house and he saw television. He looked at me and said with tremendous reproach, "And you, Brutus?" Well, he was quite upset to see the television, so I showed him in the other room another television. Well, I just happened not to agree with that gloomy outlook, fears, even atomic bombs, or population explosion, and all the things. This is a partly tremendous presumption. People somehow let themselves believe that man can destroy something he has not created, the world. It's not a man that can destroy the world. If the world should be destroyed one time, it would be done by nature and not by machine. It's, I have no fears whatsoever, because man, with all enormous knowledge, with enormous technological, with enormous penetration in nature, is still small enough, happily, very small indeed, to believe that he is in the power to destroy the humanity. No. The man can do only terrible damage to humanity, yes. Destroy? No. They are not that big, and they will never penetrate the nature and all secrets. Nature is big. My boy, when he was little, now he's the Caltech, studied biology. But when he was quite small, we sat there at the pool, and he said it was a clear, beautiful night, stars, and he looked up and he said, "Father, isn't that incredible how powerful a man's eyes are, the sight, that they don't know limits." Can you imagine the billions of years difference, the distance, and you can see, no matter what, maybe reflection or something, or rather, but you can see with your unarmed eyes. You, Father, who has to take glasses to read a book. And that is true. It's fascinating, but I never realized this. The man has an unbelievable power himself. It is true to see, to hear, to take, to realize things. But I strongly believe an incredible, beautiful, and fascinating life. And I think it is a great adventure. Don't you think so?
Yes, yes. I'm still intrigued here. I wanted certainly to talk with you as a person and not as a performing artist. And yet I can't help but bring up the question. How did it begin in your own life? As one becomes creative, there are so many sacrifices that have to be made, and so frequently these sacrifices mean turning your back on all the beauty you describe, the discipline that the performing artist must develop. The sacrifices, I imagine many of them make very poor fathers and very poor husbands. How can one give a certain part of one's life to one's family and all these beautiful things, the beauty of nature that one finds every place, and still become the proficient, sensitive, creative, performing artist?
I think it belongs together. I think it's just unfortunate cases that a great artist will be mentally sick or spend his life in great misery and very poor family life or whatever it was, or poor health most of the time, mm-hmm. bad habits, mm-hmm. Alcoholism or whatever it was. I think it is not a rule. There were quite a few very healthy people among the creative minds.
How did your father feel about you going into the performing arts?
He encouraged it. And but he made me realize that it is very hard work, and you should do it only when you don't know it is a hard work. Only that. And as a matter of fact, it is true. The moment we see, as I said before, the boredom, for instance, is the really greatest enemy of the humanity. I remember when I was very young, I was in the orchestra, and I noticed that most of the members of the orchestra were bored to death, and the only one person was vibrate and full of enthusiasm. It was the conductor. Never a rehearsal was long enough for him, while all musicians were looking at their watches and they were hoping, you see, that torture will be over. The conductor was desperate, you know, I began also to be bored together with all my colleagues. But I was very fortunate to find a cure for it. I just could not stand to be bored, because 1 hour become a year of duration. It becomes unbearable, absolutely unbearable. Well, so I said, now why the conductor is the only person who is enthusiastic, and who is full of vigor, who perspires, who... I said, well, he is just more interested in what he's doing than I. And so I began to study every score the conductor was conducting, until, to the great astonishment of my colleagues, after a rehearsal, I say, my goodness, it's all over. Can't we rehearse a little long? They thought I was joking, but it was absolutely the truth. That's the way I felt. And even once, by playing some symphony, I think it was Brahms' first symphony, with Furtwängler. It was a fine performance, and I did not play actually only my cello part. I was tremendously concerned about the entire score. And when the performance was over and the audience applauded, I stood up, I took a bow. Which the people thought was very funny. But in choral works, I used to sing with the choral. By the way, once I entered a little bit too soon, and the poor people heard my horrible voice just one bar before the chorus coming through the air. Well, but it was fun, you see. I was interested. I'm terribly grateful for that. There was another thing. My father gave me advice. This is advice. When I think I was 12, I had to leave home.
I have not signed a contract with nature that there will be a tomorrow or that there will be sunshine or rain. These are gifts. They are treasures which are bestowed upon us. And there is no end to the gratitude I feel. Such was the way that one man in the 20th century came to view his universe. This man, Gregor Piatigorsky.